This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
President Trump says a coronavirus vaccine could be ready by the end of October. Public health experts see a different timeline.
There's going to be a limited supply of vaccine, probably for a couple of years at a minimum, and some countries will be left behind.
I'm Carol Hills. Coronavirus outbreaks have swept through U.S. immigration detention centers.
So every day we wake up scared, you know, thinking that one of us gets it, we're all going to get it.
And in China, the government is fed up with people not finishing their food. So it created the Empty Plate Campaign.
When they're inviting somebody out for dinner, some people feel like they have to overorder to make a good impression.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. President Trump has pushed the idea that a coronavirus vaccine could be ready by the 1st of November, just in time for Election Day. But that's very unlikely, according to the doctor who's advising the president on the development and distribution of vaccines. Dr. Mansaf Slaoui says a COVID-19 vaccine is unlikely to be ready to distribute until the middle of next year. So how close are we globally to a coronavirus vaccine? Anna Durbin is a medical doctor and professor of international health at Johns Hopkins. She joins us from Baltimore. Anna, in the U.S., the three frontrunners are the vaccines from AstraZeneca, Moderna, and Pfizer. They've moved into phase three of testing. Are these also the most promising outside the U.S.?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think it's important to realize that there are other vaccine evaluation programs going on outside of the U.S. Some of these have made the news. For instance, the vaccine that's being evaluated in China and Russia. Unfortunately, both of those vaccine candidates haven't undergone the same phase three efficacy trial evaluation that the vaccines in the United States are undergoing. So although they're being evaluated and used in first line medical workers and such, we don't have efficacy data on those vaccines, and it's going to be very difficult to get efficacy on those vaccines. I also want to point out that the AstraZeneca vaccine will also be evaluated in countries outside of the United States. So those trials also are ongoing. The WHO has a program that is to evaluate different vaccine candidates as well, but it's not quite as far along, for instance, as Project Warp Speed here in the United States.
And Project Warp Speed is President Trump's project to get a vaccine as soon as possible.
Yes. I like to say it's the federal government's project. It's our tax dollars put to work to try to find a vaccine to protect us all from COVID.
Now, as you mentioned, for a vaccine to be in phase three of testing, it needs to be tested on a lot of people, and you need time before you can really gather and assess the data. At this point, is November 1st a feasible deadline?
I really don't believe that it is a feasible deadline. I think it's important to note that of the three vaccine trials that you mentioned, AstraZeneca, Moderna, and Pfizer, none of them has completed enrollment as we're speaking today. So they're still enrolling volunteers to reach the 30,000 volunteers that they want in each of those studies. And then you have to wait for people to actually get COVID to find out if the vaccine worked, because in all of these studies, some people get the vaccine, some people don't. And then you want to compare the number of cases in the group that got vaccine with the number of cases in the group that didn't get vaccine. So it's not just a matter of enrolling and giving the vaccine. It's also a matter of waiting over time to see how many cases of COVID accumulate in the trial to see if the vaccine works. So I think it's highly unlikely that we will have those data by the 1st of November. I think it's important to also note that the phase three study does not end when we have efficacy data. So volunteers are followed for usually a couple of years at a minimum to complete the phase three trial because people want to look at long-term safety of the vaccine as well as durability of the vaccine.
And so you're talking about typically taking years to develop a vaccine, usually around a decade. If a vaccine was developed by November, like Trump has pushed for, how can we be sure that a vaccine developed in that short span of time would be safe and effective?
So I think that's a good question. I think what's important to remember is part of the design of Project Warp Speed is to be producing these vaccines at the same time that you're doing these large phase three clinical trials, not waiting for the result of the clinical trial to begin production of the vaccine. And that's what we mean when we say we're producing these vaccines at risk, because the manufacturers are making them and the government is buying these vaccines without knowing whether or not they're going to work. But the reason they're doing that is if we do see that a vaccine is efficacious against COVID, then we will have at least a limited number of doses, for instance, that can be prioritized to those at highest risk for COVID while we continue to produce more vaccine. So I do want to stress that we don't think that the safety is really being compromised in these studies because we are enrolling tens of thousands of people, about 30,000 in each of these trials. It's true, we will only have short-term safety data. We won't have long-term safety data, but people will be followed for up to 2 years in the phase three trial and then in the phase four trial to look for safety signals.
Once a vaccine or multiple vaccines have been approved for full use, what can we expect in terms of a global rollout? I mean, who will get them and how quickly?
Well, that's an excellent question. And there is an effort by WHO to ensure equitable distribution of vaccines around the world. But I think the reality of the situation is that there are countries that are better positioned financially to purchase vaccines and to distribute vaccines. And, you know, we hope because this is a global problem, it's a global pandemic, that with efforts like WHO, we will see equitable distribution around the world. You know, my concern, and I think the concern of many public health experts, is that there's going to be a limited supply of vaccine, probably for a couple of years at a minimum, and that some countries will be left behind. This is something that has never been done before. We've never had a vaccine produced for the entire population in this short amount of time. So I think although the intent certainly is to produce vaccine and sell vaccine to the world, the reality is there's not the capacity right now to do that.
Anna Durbin is an MD and a professor of international health at Johns Hopkins. She's been speaking to us from Baltimore. Thanks, Anna.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
When we talk about the dangers of COVID-19, where you are and whether you can protect yourself from the virus matters. In the U.S., the virus has swept through jail-like immigration detention facilities, infecting more than 5,000 people. KQED's Farida Jabvala-Romero spoke with detained immigrants who've gone on hunger strikes to call attention to their conditions.
Some people detained by immigration officials are so worried about getting sick from COVID-19, they've stopped eating, often for several days.
We ate nothing at all. We just drank water the whole time.
Eduardo Melendez and 20 other immigrants recently went on hunger strike for almost a week. They're held at a jail in Yuba County, north of San Francisco. Sometimes U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, detains people at county jails. Melendez is 23, from El Salvador. His family brought him to California when he was 8.
You know, every day we wake up scared, you know, thinking that one of us gets it, we're all going to get it. And, you know, we might not be able to see our families again.
He and more than 2,000 other immigrants at detention centers across the U.S. have refused meals and protests since the pandemic began. They're being held in facilities in California, Florida, New Mexico, Ohio, and other states. That's according to Detention Watch Network, an advocacy group. The detainees have also called for more masks, soap, the chance to socially distance, and better medical care. Meanwhile, the ACLU has filed more than 40 lawsuits nationwide to force ICE to release immigrants at risk of serious illness from the disease. In California, Eduardo Melendez wants officials at the Yuba County Jail, where ICE is holding him, to test detainees and staff regularly for COVID-19 and stop accepting people from other facilities to try to stop the virus from spreading.
This should be handled properly before it's too late.
So far, no one at the jail has been confirmed with COVID-19, but lawyers for detainees say at least 3 employees there tested positive in July. ICE declined to comment, but a spokeswoman at the sheriff's office, which oversees the jail where Melendez is being held, says they've drastically limited the number of people they've taken into custody. She also says there's medical personnel on site 24/7 and that they're following daily cleaning protocols. But detainees say the place is often filthy and that it can take at least a week to see a doctor. They argue the facility isn't equipped to handle an outbreak.
They're not doing any testing. They don't give out adequate hygiene. They don't give out hand sanitizer.
Joe Mejia Rosas was held by ICE at the Yuba County Jail for nearly a year.
Social distancing is impossible in that facility. So, you know, you add all these things together and it's the perfect storm just waiting to happen.
Mejia's parents brought him from Mexico to California when he was 4. He's one of about 50 immigrants a federal judge ordered ICE to release from the jail after detainees sued.
Ultimately, I made it out of detention and now I'm trying to seek a better future.
ICE reports that it's tested nearly 30,000 detainees nationwide and that it's offering appropriate medical care to people who've tested positive for the virus. But safety concerns persist. Judges have ordered more than 500 immigrants so far to be released from detention centers across the U.S., says Eunice Cho. She's with the ACLU's National Prison Project, which has pushed for immigrants to be let out, especially those at risk for COVID-19.
People with diabetes, with immunocompromised systems, people who had cancer. In addition, in some of our cases, not all, the courts have also released people because of the fact that the lower the number of people in the facility, I think the greater protection it provides for everybody else.
But Cho says there are still many medically vulnerable immigrants still in detention. At least 6 people in ICE custody have died due to COVID-19, including 2 men in their 70s. This summer, ICE says it began testing all newly arrived detainees at the facilities it owns, but that does not include detention centers run by for-profit companies, where most immigrants are held. For The World, I'm Farida Javala Romero.
The cruise ship industry used to sound like this.
Experience a whole new world the moment you step on board. The sea is calling. Answer it with Royal Caribbean.
Now it sounds like this. Yep, not a lot of advertising for an industry that's been struggling since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. Cruise ships became the last place vacationers wanted to be after a number of coronavirus outbreaks happened at sea. But if you want to have that cruise ship experience without the buffet or the lounge singers, Paul Durham is the man to see. Durham is taking passengers out on his ferry off the coast of Dorset to see the cruise ships that are moored for the time being in the English Channel. He brings them right up close.
It's a bit surreal, really, but it's a good view because you haven't got anything in the way. Even if you're in a port somewhere, there's always buildings in the way. So you get a fantastic view of these big ships.
Durham told the CBC program As It Happens that he charges £20 for the tour. That's about $25. He spends 2.5 hours regaling his passengers with everything he knows about cruise ships, and that's a lot because he used to work on one. Their height, weight, passenger capacity, the food, the entertainment. That's, of course, when they're actually functioning. The maximum capacity on some ships is 6,000 people. These days, they have around 80 or 100, a captain, security, maintenance, and a skeleton staff to keep things running. Paul Durham finds that many who take his tour already know something about cruise ships.
Some of the passengers have actually been on the ships. We were going around Allura of the Seas the other day, and 2 of our passengers had been on it quite recently. And they suddenly said, oh, we can still get the Wi-Fi.
Well, thank heavens for that. Coming up, a battle over who owns some of Iraq's ancient artifacts. You're listening to The World. For months, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un claimed that there were no cases of the coronavirus in his country. But that might not be true anymore. Last month, Kim himself admitted things were not going well. This was a startling admission, but there were few details. North Korea is a subject tackled by our friends at the Intelligence Podcast. It's produced by Economist Radio in London. Jason Palmer is the host. Jason, who did you speak to about this rare admission from Kim Jong-un, and what are we to make of it?
Well, I think the only reaction here is one of surprise. This is a regime that tends to announce nothing but bombastic successes. Mr. Kim told the party that due to, quote, unexpected difficulties, the government had failed to improve people's lives to meet its economic goals. So I spoke to Lena Shipper, who's the Economist's bureau chief in Seoul, and she said there are several things at work here, just cratering the economy. There's the pandemic, of course, but the longer-run effects of international sanctions are really starting to bite. And on top of that, there have been huge amounts of flooding of monsoons threatening the harvest and so on. All this while the country has been entirely sealed off. The provisions for the pandemic were swift and severe.
So Kim sealed off the country, but it didn't work. What do we know about COVID-19 cases in North Korea?
Well, I asked Lena about that, about the claim that North Korea was entirely COVID-free. And you can imagine there has been some real skepticism about that claim. But in July, that changed. And here's her answer.
We don't know for sure. But in July, there was a repentant defector who returned from South Korea across the border between the two countries. And North Korea sort of used that opportunity and said, well, he's a suspected case of COVID, and the test they conducted on him was inconclusive. And since then, they've stopped claiming quite so fervently that they're entirely COVID-free, but they still haven't admitted that they have any cases of COVID, only that they've tested some people and that they're quarantining many.
But what about those strict and swift border closures? How's that looking now?
Well, there were a few points over the past few months where it kind of looked like it was easing a bit. We got reports of, you know, trucks getting through again or trains getting through again, sea routes being reopened. But recently that's tightened again. And for all we know, the border remains largely closed. Trade with China, which is the main trading partner North Korea has all but ceased. During the first half of the year, the value of all the trade conducted between the two countries was $400 million, which is a reduction of 2/3 approximately compared with last year. So it essentially went from very little to virtually nothing.
So a weak economy weakened further by natural disasters of more than one sort. What does that look like on the ground?
Well, in the spring, we saw the first results in Pyongyang in the capital, which is quite unusual because they tend to make sure that people in the capital are well fed and it kind of looks good from the outside. So there were reports of usually well-stocked shops that ran out of or short of many consumer goods. They rationed staple foods like cooking oil. There were a few reports of North Koreans asking their foreign colleagues to buy scarce items for them from shops that are reserved for foreigners. And the fact that it was that bad in Pyongyang suggests that it's probably much worse in the provinces. We don't have any first-hand reports from there, or very few. But the likelihood that things are much worse outside of Pyongyang, where people can't see, is very high.
That's Lena Shipper, the Economist bureau chief in Seoul, speaking to Jason Palmer. Jason, how bad could things get for North Korea? I mean, it's such an isolated country.
And isolated by design, right? That's the thing. As Lena says, there are just so few firsthand reports that it's hard to know how much we'll know anyway. But in any case, it seems beyond doubt that things are going to get a lot worse. Even state media admitted last month that the flooding was probably going to affect the rice harvest. The typhoon season is just starting. That's bound to make matters much worse. And those lockdown provisions are still really tight, so the humanitarian aid that normally follows natural disasters is going to be even tougher to bring in than it usually is. Now, will it get as bad as the famine that devastated the country in the 1990s? Lena doesn't think so, but that's a terribly low bar to clear.
Sure is. That's Jason Palmer, host of the Intelligence Podcast, brought to us by our friends at Economist Radio in London. Jason, thanks so much.
Been a pleasure.
Exceptionally rare carvings, ancient Egyptian scrolls, a legendary tablet dating back to 1600 BC. Those are just some of the artifacts in the collection at the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. The museum was founded by Hobby Lobby CEO David Green, but many of the thousands of artifacts owned by the museum rightly belong to the people of Iraq. Now the museum and Hobby Lobby is close to reaching a deal with the Iraqi government to return those artifacts, but who does the deal actually benefit? Patty Gerstenblith is the director of the Center for Art, Museum, and Cultural Heritage Law at DePaul University in Chicago. She's also previously advised David Green and Hobby Lobby.
The Hobby Lobby Corporation acquired many thousands of artifacts from different countries, particularly from Egypt and from Iraq, over roughly the past 10 years. In approximately 2014, the Hobby Lobby Corporation acquired a very significant tablet known as the Gilgamesh Dream Tablet. And that was on loan to the Museum of the Bible when the U.S. government seized it close to a year ago.
And how is it determined that these artifacts were basically looted or were obtained illegally?
Its illegality is based on a variety of factors, but most particularly, Iraq enacted what's called a national ownership law in the 1930s. Any archaeological artifact removed from Iraq after that time without the permission of the Iraqi government is considered under U.S. law to be stolen property. Iraqi sites, archaeological sites, and museums were looted on a very large scale following 1991, after the initial Gulf War. So many artifacts came out of Iraq illegally at that time.
So what's in the deal that Hobby Lobby and the Museum of the Bible is offering to Iraq in terms of returning these artifacts?
First of all, Hobby Lobby and the Museum of the Bible, that seem to be acting together as a single party, are offering to return the Gilgamesh tablet, which, as I mentioned, is already in the custody of the U.S. government anyway, and is offering to return some number of other objects. The agreement does not state how many objects or which objects they're offering to return, at least not to my knowledge, which is itself a big problem, because under the way the legal system works in the U.S., it's very likely that Iraq's title to the Gilgamesh tablet will be recognized under U.S. law, regardless of any agreement. So without knowing what other objects are at issue and whether they are here legally or illegally, an offer from Hobby Lobby and the museum to return something could be meaningless because those things already may well belong to Iraq.
I'm reading that Iraqis are upset about this proposed deal. What are they upset about?
Well, the other part of the deal is that Hobby Lobby is offering to give $15 million to the Iraqis. But here again, there's a lot of problems because we have to remember that another part of the agreement is Iraq will be giving up any claim or right to anything else or claim against Hobby Lobby and the museum for anything they've done so far. So the only thing left on the table that Iraqis might be getting is the $15 million. Well, they don't want to sell their heritage for any amount of money. If you have thousands and thousands of objects that have been looted from Iraq, the damage that's been done is huge. And any payment should be not in exchange for giving up title, but should be just an acknowledgement of the damage that's been done and the harm to Iraq's cultural heritage.
Patty Gerstenblith is the director of the Center for Art, Museum, and Cultural Heritage Law at DePaul University. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for talking.
Did you miss something on The World Today? Subscribe to The World's Latest Edition podcast and take the show with you wherever you go. Find us in your favorite podcast app or at theworld.org/podcast. And you're listening to The World. Coming up, why Disney's new Mulan movie is facing a boycott. And in Bulgaria, protesters are demanding that their prime minister resign.
This is a sacrifice that you have to do. Otherwise, you basically settle for something that's immoral.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of GBH and PRX. Tomorrow in Brazil, they'll be celebrating the annual Day of the Amazon. But for many people, it won't really be a celebration. COVID-19 has hit the indigenous peoples of the Amazon region especially hard. Nearly 30,000 have been infected. Almost 800 people have died. Indigenous communities blame Brazil's government for failing to respond. But as Michael Fox reports, they're taking action to protect themselves.
It's mid-August. Dozens of Kayapo indigenous warriors chant while blocking a major highway in Brazil's Amazonian state of Pará. They're bare-chested and wearing yellow headdresses. They're demanding that the state take action against the spread of COVID-19 in their territories and block invaders from their land. People seeking to log, mine, or steal indigenous land have increased the deforestation on Kayapo territory by more than 400% just during the pandemic. A week after the protest, gunmen attacked a checkpoint established by another group of Kayapo to protect their village. The outlaws fired 30 shots, though no one was harmed. Brazilian officials say they've been working to defend indigenous peoples. General Alexandre Ribeiro, the commander of the military's COVID-19 operation, spoke with state TV in June.
Nós estamos protegendo as comunidades indígenas, impedindo que pessoas...
We're protecting indigenous communities and stopping outsiders from entering their lands and convincing them not to leave their territory.
But many indigenous peoples say they have been neglected by the Brazilian government during the pandemic. Mario Nicasio helps run the network of indigenous organizations of the Brazilian Amazon, COABI, one of the largest indigenous groups in the region.
Por exemplo, no início, as comunidades não receberam medicamentos sequer.
In the beginning, our communities didn't even receive medicine, not even a mask.
E nem para a equipe também. Muitas vezes aqui a equipe.
And sometimes medical teams went to communities and infected our people.
Compared to what it spent the year before, the government has actually decreased spending on indigenous health since the pandemic started. That's according to a report from Brazil's Socioeconomic Studies Institute. Leila Saraiva is one of the study authors.
E a conclusão que a gente chegou é que é isso, né? A gente está diante de uma paralisia do Estado, né?
Our conclusion is that we are facing a paralysis of the state, but a paralysis that is constantly denied by the administrators. And it's shocking, because we know how serious this is for indigenous communities.
Mario Nicasio of COABI was aware early on of the threat COVID-19 posed to indigenous communities. The organization began rolling out its plan just weeks after the virus arrived.
Foram adquiridos EPIs, equipamento de proteção individual, remédio, teste, até o teste rápido.
We acquired personal protective equipment, medicine, and even quick tests for COVID-19. We had to buy them because the federal government was not yet testing indigenous people, and we have been setting up primary health clinics in communities.
They also help spread the word across communities about how to defend against the virus.
Desde 4 horas da manhã que nós tomamos a decisão de fechar aqui a porteira aqui da nossa comunidade.
We've been here since 4 a.m., says the chief of an indigenous Pataxó village in this YouTube video, which was posted in May. He's joined by 9 members of the village who have created what they call a sanitation barrier. It's essentially a checkpoint where they only allow in people they trust. The villagers are all wearing face masks, and they're armed with bottles of soap and detergent to make sure visitors are disinfected before they pass. Barriers like this have been erected by native communities across Brazil. APIBE, the country's largest indigenous organization, has launched a campaign to mobilize support and funds for its COVID defense work. Sonia Guajajara is a well-known indigenous activist and leads the organization.
Nós queremos criar alternativas de isolamento para os indígenas infectados.
We want to create alternative places where infected people can be isolated. We need to guarantee primary medical attention in the communities so that our people don't have to be taken to the hospitals in the city.
The problem is, Brazil's indigenous peoples aren't just facing COVID-19. They're also confronted by land invasions, deforestation, massive forest fires, and a constant push from the government to roll back their rights. But they say the strength of the planet depends on their survival, and they have promised to fight. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
If this has been a hot, hot summer where you live, you're far from alone. Heat waves have hit much of the northern hemisphere, and that includes the North Pole of all places. Extreme heat there has contributed to record-breaking Arctic wildfires. They've been burning in Siberian forests since May. In some satellite maps, smoke plumes blanket big swaths of the region. The European Union's atmosphere monitoring service, Copernicus, says the fires have also released record levels of greenhouse gas emissions. Copernicus scientist and wildfire expert Mark Parrington joins me now from Reading, England. Mark, how bad have the fires been this year?
The fires have been quite bad in terms of the size of them and the persistence of them.
Is the level of fires this year unprecedented?
It's clearly something we haven't seen before in the 18 years of data that we have. Last summer, we saw a lot of widespread fire activity in the Siberian Arctic again. And that was the first time we'd really seen anything at that scale. This year, it's a bit less of a surprise, but actually the fact that the emissions are that much higher, about 30% higher, starts to make it look like another unprecedented year. It's not unusual to see occasional wildfires within the Arctic Circle. But what we've seen the last 2 years is them burning for several weeks rather than several days.
It's kind of hard to get your head around the idea of wildfires in the Arctic. What causes these fires so far north?
So that's one of the big unknowns. They could be caused naturally through lightning, for example, or they could be human caused, whether deliberately or accidentally. And then also there's speculation about whether holdover or so-called zombie fires might act as an ignition source at the start of the season.
What are zombie fires?
These are fires that can burn at low temperatures. So they smolder underground through the winter months, even when the ground above them is frozen. And then in the spring, as their ground thaws, they can potentially resurface and reignite new fires.
What are the environmental implications of this?
These fires produce huge amounts of smoke. That smoke comprises of a wide range of pollutants, some of them which are very toxic and harmful to human health. Under the right meteorological conditions, that smoke can also be transported potentially over thousands of kilometres, where it may then affect air quality in another country or another part of the world.
What's the climate change connection here? I mean, I imagine these emissions will make climate change worse, but climate change also makes for hotter summers, meaning more fires. Is this a vicious cycle that's tough to kind of end?
Well, of course, there are going to be climate feedbacks from these fires. They might not be so apparent immediately. So, for example, the fires will leave a mark on the landscape, which could affect the albedo or how much sunlight gets reflected from the surface. A darker surface will absorb more sunlight and then contribute to a warming atmosphere. So, yes, there will be climate feedbacks, but they might not be so obvious immediately. And it's a sort of an area of active research that we don't really cover in the Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring so much.
So what's to be done about these Arctic fires? Can they be reined in, or do we just kind of sit and watch them burn?
They do try to combat these fires, particularly when they threaten infrastructure or population centres. There are efforts to try and dig fire trenches and fire breaks to try and prevent them from spreading too far. But it could just be the case that some of these fires are so remote that it's not really possible to direct resources to actually combat them when they're burning.
So how worried should we be about this?
I mean, it's clearly concerning. It's a symptom of the fact that climate change is occurring at a faster rate in the high northern latitudes, more so than in the globally average sense. The impacts on air quality and human health are very direct. As these fires burn, if they continue each summer to burn for several weeks at a time, that leads to a lot of air pollution that is going to, you know, really degrade the quality of life of people living in that area.
Mark Parrington is a senior scientist with the Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Okay, thank you. No problem.
For nearly 2 months straight, Bulgarians have been taking to the streets. They're calling for the resignation of Prime Minister Boyko Borisov and his government. And demonstrators say they're not giving up until he steps down. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry has the story.
Night after night, crowds have been gathering in the Bulgarian capital, Sofia, chanting one word. Resignation, resignation. Up until this week, the demonstrations have been largely peaceful. But on Wednesday night, as tens of thousands turned up outside Parliament, things got ugly. Protesters threw rocks and bottles at police lines, and they got pepper spray and beatings with batons in return. More than 120 people were arrested. But the crackdown hasn't stopped the marchers. Last night, they were back on the streets of Sofia. Among them was 32-year-old Valentina Dolmova.
I don't have a moral alternative.
Dolmova, who's a psychologist, says she feels an obligation to be at the protests every night.
This is a sacrifice that you have to do. Otherwise, you basically settle for something that's immoral.
Getting to the heart of what sparked these demonstrations is complicated. In early July, there was a police raid on the offices of the president, a vocal critic of Prime Minister Borisov. That made a lot of people angry. The president's supporters say the raid was a deliberate attempt to delay investigations into corruption by the country's political elite. Audio recordings of the Prime Minister cursing his political opponents have come out. So has a photo of him sleeping with a gun by his bed and an open drawer full of cash nearby. Borisov says that photo is a fake. But at the root of it all, many Bulgarians say, is a sense of exhaustion.
People are fed up with corruption, duplicity.
Petar Chulikov is an associate professor of sociology at the Bulgarian Academy of Sciences.
More and more people are fed up with representatives of government constantly violating the constitution and laws in this country.
Among 27 EU member states, Transparency International ranks Bulgaria as the most corrupt of all. And it's not just politicians who are implicated. Allegations of corruption have plagued the judicial system for years. Chulikov says even ordinary Bulgarian citizens have a role to play.
A lot of Bulgarians, whenever they have a problem, if they're asked for a bribe, they're prepared to give this bribe because they think that nothing else is going to solve their problem.
As the protests have grown louder, European Union officials in Brussels have mostly kept quiet. A few EU lawmakers have voiced concern. But Dimitar Beshev says the Bulgarian Prime Minister has been politically savvy about winning over his EU colleagues.
He's somebody who never rocks the boat in Brussels.
Beshev lectures on Eastern Europe and Russia at the University of North Carolina.
He's close to Chancellor Merkel and pretty much to every other international leader. But the flip side is that he expects that there won't be any questions asked about what happens inside Bulgaria.
Early on, Prime Minister Borisov hinted that he would give in to protesters' demands and step down. But he has since reversed himself. Dimitar Beshev says Borisov appears to be ready to do whatever it takes to stay in power.
Prime Minister Borisov wants to keep the ball rolling and ultimately have elections in March when the regular date is, as opposed to handing power to a caretaker government to oversee elections. His calculation is that he'll be better off and his party will be better off.
Resigning now could also leave Borisov vulnerable to prosecution. But protesters say they won't wait until 2021 to see him out of office. Here's Valentina Dolmova again.
It needs to be now.
If Borisov resigns, it wouldn't be his first time. He's been forced out of office twice before. As one expert tells me, this is a politician who's got 9 lives. And nobody knows just how many he's got left. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The pandemic, combined with crushing U.S. sanctions, has left Iran's economy struggling, and ordinary Iranians are feeling the pressure. Last year, for example, there was a spike in gasoline prices that sparked nationwide street protests that were met with a harsh response by the government. Amnesty International conducted an investigation into how the crackdown played out. A heads up here, for the next 3.5 minutes, we're going to hear details of what researchers called shocking human rights violations by authorities in Iran. Mansoura Mills helped research the report, and she joins us now. Mansoura, remind us of the circumstances that led to the protests in Iran last year.
The protests were triggered when the Iranian government made an announcement that it would raise the price of petrol significantly threefold. So really, the protests started in response to this very sudden government announcement. However, once the protests began, they soon evolved into anti-establishment protests. So the protesters who were out in the streets used this protest as an opportunity to air their grievances about human rights violations, about political oppression, authoritarianism.
So a government hike in gas prices sends people out into the street. Who are these people? Was it a broad cross-section of Iranians or young people or old? How would you describe it?
There were people from all walks of life, but a majority of the protesters were young, and they were also from the lower socioeconomic backgrounds, people who would be significantly affected by a huge rise in the price of petrol.
Your report makes some serious claims about the Iranian government response to the protests. What happened?
Hundreds of people were killed in broad daylight, unarmed protesters and bystanders who were running away, had their backs to the security forces, gunned down in the streets. At the same time, more than 7,000 men, women and children were arrested during the protests. Our research uncovered gruesome torture allegations. For example, we discovered that some male detainees were subjected to sexual violence and humiliation through being stripped naked, Some had their testicles sprayed with pepper spray or were given electric shocks to their testicles. One detainee told us that he was subjected to waterboarding. Others were forced to ingest unidentified pills. I mean, the catalogue of human rights violations and the gruesome torture methods is really unending.
Now, there is a case that President Trump is focusing attention on, and that's the case of Navid Afkari. He was involved in a series of protests in Iran in 2018. He was convicted of murdering a security guard. President Trump is called on Iran to overturn his death sentence. Tell us about this case.
We have concerns that this young man's trial was grossly unfair. He was denied access to a lawyer at the investigation phase of his case and has said that he was forced to make confessions under torture. Amnesty International is calling for the Iranian authorities to immediately quash his death sentence. Unfortunately, Navid Afkari's case is just another piece of evidence that the Iranian authorities will go to any length to crush dissent.
But is what President Trump doing helpful? Is that going to yield any results?
I think that any attention that is brought to the case of this young man who is facing the death penalty in Iran can be a positive move. And any attention that can be brought onto these protesters and anything that can help to save their lives is good.
Mansoori Mills of Amnesty International telling us about a new report about mistreatment of protesters and abuses by authorities last year in Iran. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
90s kids or parents, you'll remember Disney's Mulan. The animated film from 1998 is based on a Chinese legend. It's about a young woman who disguises herself as a male soldier to fight invaders from the north so her father doesn't have to. Here, she is absolutely dominating in the film's final fight scene.
Shang, go!
Well, there's a new Mulan in town. Today, Disney releases its live-action Mulan on the Disney Plus streaming service.
Loyal, brave, and true. It is my duty to protect my family.
But this time, there are calls for a boycott. I urge everyone who believes in human rights to hashtag boycott Mulan. Those words from prominent Hong Kong activist Joshua Wong on Twitter. Wong was heavily involved in protests last year against a law that would allow extradition from Hong Kong to mainland China. The protests grew into a movement demanding democratic reforms, autonomy, and investigations into police brutality against protesters. Last August, when clashes between pro-democracy demonstrators and police were at their most intense, the actress who plays Mulan, Liu Yifei, shared these words on her social media. I support the Hong Kong police. You can all attack me now. What a shame for Hong Kong. Her words drew swift condemnation from around the world, and they haven't stopped. Today, one Twitter user shared a photo of the original cartoon Mulan with the caption, "My Mulan doesn't support police brutality." Other boycotters have called Agnes Chow, a young pro-democracy activist in Hong Kong, the real Mulan. In the old animated version of the film, Mulan's family begs her to restore their honor. But of this new Mulan, one Twitter user says, Liu Yifei, you won't bring honor to us all. Clean your plate. That's something I heard growing up here in the U.S. In China, people are hearing the same from the highest levels of government. Chinese leader Xi Jinping himself has issued a directive to the nation to stop wasting food. The campaign is called Operation Empty Plate, and it's aimed at reducing the level of food waste nationwide. According to one study, China throws away enough food to feed between 30 and 50 million people a year. The World's Rebecca Kanther reports from Shanghai.
Business is back to normal at a popular hot pot restaurant in Chengdu. Groups sit around circular tables dipping meat and vegetables into the bubbling broth. The owner, Lai Shengqiang, says that many of his customers invite friends or business contacts for meals at his restaurant.
When they're inviting somebody out for dinner, some people feel like they have to overorder to make a good impression.
And this is what's led to a long-term problem in China, food waste. President Xi has tried to tackle this before. Back in 2013, a propaganda campaign reminded people, especially government agencies, to scale back on banquets piled high with food. This year, he's calling on the general public to think more about the issue of food security. The pandemic, flooding throughout China, and trade tensions with other countries all highlight the need to protect food supplies. Lai says the local restaurant association dropped by to inform him about Operation Empty Plate, but they didn't give him any specific guidelines to follow. So he has to figure out how to comply.
Every restaurant has their own approach. We're going to offer our customers two different portion sizes and sharing plates. That way, they can still feel like they have more options and can try more dishes.
Since family-style sharing is the norm here, restaurant servers are used to giving advice on how many dishes to order. But in the wake of Xi's campaign, some restaurants might have gone a bit too far. A restaurant in Changsha had to apologize after they put scales outside the front door for customers to weigh themselves. One viral video showed a manager eating his customers' leftovers. He's not the only one. Several videos capture teachers eating their students' leftover food. But Xi's directive has put pressure on one extremely niche group: live streaming competitive eaters. They're known as big stomachs. Their videos show people chomping their way through tables full of food, and in one case, downing an entire roast lamb in one sitting. They have a huge following here. But now, because of Operation Empty Plate, they've been essentially banned from broadcasting online. Today, when you search for Big Stomach on social media, the first result that pops up is this. It's a short video from China State News reminding people not to waste food. Most of the eating videos have been scrubbed, but a few still managed to get online. This one features a young woman wearing a checked gingham blouse and a big bow in her hair, very much a girl next door look. In the 7-minute video, she polishes off a big plate of udon noodles, a can of peaches, a bowl of black sesame rice dumplings, 3 dessert rolls, and a milk pudding dessert. It's no wonder the name she posts under is Can't Get Full. Lai Shengqiang, the restaurant owner, remembers a time when he actually couldn't get full. He was born in the years after the Great Famine, which killed tens of millions of people in the 1950s.
Well, it was a different time then. It was a planned economy, and we couldn't always eat as much as we wanted.
So he thinks the government's Operation Empty Plate makes sense. He looks at some of his customers' ordering habits and wishes they weren't so wasteful. Most of them accept his reminders to order less.
But some more traditional people, probably those who've been through harder times, think, I have money now. Or they think that this is a way to show their generosity.
Some people in China don't see things the way Lai does. They think the new campaign is an attempt to control another aspect of ordinary people's lives. A few restaurant owners I talked to are ignoring it. They don't want to offend their customers. But Lai says it's good for the country to plan ahead and try to prevent problems later on. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Here's a dilemma. When lots of people had to start working from home, what happened to all those office plants? That question was posed by Tumblr user Waffles Risa in the United Kingdom. Before the pandemic, she worked at a law firm in a 12-story office building where people left behind hundreds of plants. She assumed they'd all die. But a few months later came news that the plants were safe and thriving. Security guards at the building, still coming into work, had gathered every office plant from every floor and set them up in a makeshift greenhouse in the cafeteria. They even labeled each one with the owner's name and desk location. Waffles Risa says she's grateful.
Feedback. Does it have to be human? Feedback. Does it have to be mine? Feedback. Where am I supposed to get it?
Machine war. Feed me all night long. That's right, boy. You can do it.
From the London cast of Little Shop of Horrors. And as always, the world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Marco Werman will be back on Monday. Until then, have a great weekend.